The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, An Improper Pact, a class action suit brought against Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill over possible collusion surrounding professor pay could have far-reaching financial implications for colleges across the nation. And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, With millions at stake, UNC and Duke accused of conspiring about professors. Schools accused of no poach agreement that dates back decades. And this is written by Connie Gentry. The Battle of the Blues is raging again, only this time UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University are on the same team as they face professors in a class action lawsuit with broad implications on the two campuses. The issue is whether the schools have conspired not to poach professors from the other school. And the plaintiffs say the deal has been around for decades, stifling faculty members' options to progress their careers and make more money. Lucia Benatti, a Spanish professor at UNC since 1990, is the named plaintiff in the case and represents the proposed class of all non-medical faculty at both schools. This case is important to me because it's about a basic right of all workers to have their job opportunities and pay determined by market competition, not by secret deals between employers not to compete, Benatti says. In May 2019, a no-poaching suit involving the medical faculty at both schools resulted in Duke agreeing to pay a $54.5 million settlement. Both schools were slapped with injunctive relief to prevent anti-competitive agreements from happening in the future. In that case, more than 5,400 members of the medical faculties received a check for roughly $10,000 each. And that case set the stage for the current lawsuit, which is a much broader, sweeping allegation claiming the schools colluded as far back as the 1970s when it comes to their key academic personnel. We intend to vigorously defend the allegations in this suit, says Michael Schoenfeld, Chief Communications and Government Relations Officer at Duke University. Dean M. Harvey, an attorney with the San Francisco firm representing the employees in both cases, said they filed the first case in 2015 on behalf of Dr. Danielle Seaman, a radiologist at Duke Medical School, who applied to work at UNC, but was told the schools had an agreement not to raid each other. What we learned was that the no-poaching agreement actually went much further back in time and included the entire universities, Harvey alleges. After the settlement for the medical faculty, the attention turned to the rest of the faculty, and a class action suit was filed May 27 in the U.S. District Court in the Middle District of North Carolina on behalf of Benatti against Duke. This suit alleges the express purpose of the no-poach understanding was to suppress the pay of Duke and UNC faculty, and it claims the schools first reached this understanding long ago, no later than 1974. Senior administrators of both institutions periodically reaffirmed and policed the understanding throughout the subsequent decades. That time frame is astonishing. The suit alleges that the deal dates back to before Phil Ford even dribbled a basketball for UNC. And when Mike Krzyzewski was still a young captain in the U.S. Army, the implications are the deal would have been followed for decades by dozens of leaders at both schools. Duke, a private school with an endowment that has surpassed $8 billion, tends to pay 20% more than UNC for its non-medical faculty. In the 2018 to 2019 school year, the average salary for professors at Duke was $201,860. At UNC Chapel Hill, it was $160,643. And at neighboring NC State University, it was $128,640, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education. Targeting Duke. Although Benatti teaches at UNC, Duke is the defendant because what has negatively impacted Benatti is the collusion between UNC and Duke, the suit claims. It's a conspiracy case, and in conspiracy cases, every member of the conspiracy is responsible for the harm not only to their own employees, but also to the employees of every other member of the conspiracy, Harvey alleges. Even though Duke is the only defendant, the class here includes all of the non-medical faculty at Duke and all of the non-medical faculty at UNC, he says. As part of the resolution of the medical faculty suit, UNC and Duke agreed to train their administrators and faculty in antitrust laws and to certify once a year for 5 years that they were operating in compliance with the laws. Additionally, the unwritten rule for not hiring faculty from the other school officially came to an end on February 5, 2018, which was the effective date of the settlement reached in the medical faculty lawsuit. This is also the date when the current class period will be ended. Given the injunctive relief we've already obtained, the only thing left is to try to get compensation for the other faculty members whose pay was suppressed, Harvey states, adding that another reason the suit is filed solely against Duke is because as a public university, UNC is not liable for money damages in the same way that Duke would be. While UNC doesn't hold the same monetary liability as Duke, testimony from the first case suggests that both schools discussed the no-poach agreement across a number of decades. As recently as 2011, the current suit reports that Peter Lang, then the provost at Duke, had an in-person discussion with Holden Thorpe, then chancellor at UNC. Thorpe testified in the first lawsuit that Lang told him Carolina should not try to move Duke faculty to UNC because if we did, Duke had a lot more money than we did and we were going to come out on the losing end of that deal. Subsequently, the current suit claims Thorpe exchanged internal UNC emails that referenced the no-poach understanding. Thorpe, now editor-in-chief for the Science family of journals in Washington, D.C., declined to comment on the matter. Similarly, the lawsuit notes that at a dean's cabinet meeting on October 1, 2001, senior administrators at Duke, including Nannerl Keehane, then president of the university, discussed the arrangement and concluded, "There has been a casual understanding between Duke and UNC that no recruiting would take place between the two institutions. It is mutually advantageous to both schools to adhere to this practice." In 1995, Thomas Keller, who was the dean of Duke's Fuqua School of Business, wrote Keehane to complain that his counterpart at UNC was recruiting Duke faculty in violation of the no-poaching understanding. The lawsuit states, "Keller asked Keehane to get the UNC chancellor to abide by our interinstitutional agreements of not aggressively seeking faculty and staff from the other institution, which basically has the end result of increasing salaries at both institutions," he said. His concern was not that faculty would jump ship to UNC, but that Duke would have to offer higher pay, which could lead to internal inequity and potentially to bad attitudes among the Duke faculty. At that time, Keller also confirmed he had known the understanding not to poach had been in place for as long as he had been dean, which dated to 1974. As Harvey notes, "One understanding part about this case is that it goes back so far. Usually in these kinds of conspiracy cases, they go back maybe 3 or 4 years. Here we have documents that show the understanding between Duke and UNC goes back at least to the 1970s and maybe before. We took a lot of discovery in the first case to really get a sense of what was going on, and so we're starting this case with the benefit of having done all that work already." Duke is determined to meet the current battle head-on and make its own case. Duke Schoenfeld adds that the university actively competes for the most talented faculty from around the world to fulfill our missions of education and research, and are, and always have been, committed to complying with all relevant laws in our recruitment and retention efforts. UNC declined to comment on the current suit or its hiring practices. No non-competes. One obvious question is why the schools haven't asked professors to sign non-compete agreements, particularly if the objective of the two schools was to retain faculty and suppress wage negotiations. As Harvey explains, "The standards vary from state to state, and if you're in a state that allows non-compete agreements, which North Carolina does, the agreement will be enforceable as long as it's tailored to the geographic scope. There's some time limit on it, and it doesn't prevent someone from practicing their profession. There's no real federal antitrust risk there." But no-poaching agreements are different. The Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission published guidance for human resources professionals in October 2016, and that document articulates that these agreements are illegal, even if nothing is formally communicated, spoken, or put into writing, and that the HR professionals and companies participating in such agreements could face both criminal and civil prosecution. And Michael A. Olivas, professor emeritus at the University of Houston Law Center, says the competition for top faculty will only become stiffer. This is an issue that is likely to become more prominent than it has in the past, largely because under the current Trump administration, it's hard to import international talent, he says. No-poach agreements are hardly confined to universities. For example, a landmark class action suit against 7 of the largest technology companies, including Apple, Google, and Intel, was resolved in settlements totaling $435 million. In April, a class action suit was filed on behalf of former Saks Fifth Avenue employees, claiming the retailer had conspired with luxury brands including Louis Vuitton, Fendi, Laura Piana, Gucci, Prada, and Brunello Cucinelli to prevent hiring each other's employees. These unlawful no-poach agreements restrict mobility and opportunities for workers, thereby artificially depressing worker compensation, noted Inessa M. Hewitt, attorney with Faruqi and Faruqi LLP, which represents the plaintiffs in the Saks lawsuit. Hewitt and others argue that a competitive labor market enhances the productivity and performance of people and industry, including those in university settings. The point of the agreement between Duke and UNC was not to try to prevent the hiring of Professor Smith or Professor Doe. It was to eliminate a form of competition across the whole university, Harvey says. And the way that pay is set, and this is going to be part of what we have to prove in the case, is that it's not just an individual negotiation with the faculty member conducted in some vacuum. It's part of a pay structure for the whole university. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. First headline, hockey returns, but there's no roaring at PNC Arena. The PNC Arena is eerily silent now as the Carolina Hurricanes return to the ice in Canada for the National Hockey League's abbreviated season. The Canes last played in Raleigh February 28, losing to Colorado 3-2. But Carolina is in Toronto for the NHL playoffs, opening a playoff series on August 1 against the New York Rangers. The financial implications on the team are obvious. The Hurricanes, as part of their agreement with the Centennial Authority, benefit from game day revenue and the rising riches that come with being in the playoffs. For the authority, Executive Director Jeff Merritt notes that revenue from the Canes is rent-related. Under the current lease, the Hurricanes' rent is due whether they play or not, he says. Merritt says the Canes have not yet asked for a reduction in rent, but he notes that the Centennial Authority, with a projected budget of $15.8 million for the fiscal year that began July 1, will still feel the impact of the pandemic as Wake County's hospitality taxes continue to be much lower than projections. 7% of that revenue goes to the Centennial Authority. That's where we are seeing real pain, he says. Merritt also notes that PNC can ask for an abatement on its signage deal with no games being played, and the loss of games has a ripple effect across the market impacting hotels, restaurants, and bars. The authority does have more than $8 million in reserve for emergencies, but Merritt notes that even though the NHL is back on the ice, the authority is carefully monitoring what's ahead, knowing there is no real telling when the games are on again in Raleigh. Durham Inn likely headed to auction. A Durham Inn is likely to be auctioned off after two failed buyouts. The King's Daughters Inn, whose parent company, Memento Mori, filed for bankruptcy protection in 2018, is undergoing foreclosure proceedings in Durham after two attempts to sell failed. Attorney Rebecca Redwine of Hendren, Redwine, and Malone says after the pandemic hit, the inn had to shut down operations, and unfortunately, Memento Mori could not sustain the payments due to the sudden significant decrease in revenue. Pinnacle Bank has opted to move forward with foreclosure. Pinnacle, in a filing in April, claimed Memento Mori was not making the $21,590 monthly payments required in the bankruptcy plan and hadn't paid up since December. The process is ongoing, and an auction has not been scheduled on the inn, which dates back to the 1920s. Home on prestigious Raleigh Street, now back on the market. After spending over 2 years in bankruptcy court, ending in a contentious foreclosure sale, a historic estate on a prestigious Raleigh street is for sale again. The sales for sale signs just went up at 2529 White Oak Road, a hilltop estate dating to 1938. Chapel Residential lists several possibilities for the property, including use as one large estate or multiple lots. The property is just under 3 acres and zoned R2, allowing for up to 2 homes per acre. Anuj and Vanita Mittal, owners of the MJM Group of Hotels, paid $2.1 million for the property October 9 after a bankruptcy sale. Celeste Broughton previously owned the home. The home's grand front is believed to have been the inspiration for the chic Charleston Gardens restaurant at B. Altman & Company, once an upscale department store in New York City. Anuj Mittal originally told Triangle Business Journal he and his wife plan to make the location their primary residence, adding, "Our long-term plan is to demolish it and rebuild," he said. Those plans appear to have changed with the home for sale again. Pandemic impacts even the former home of R.J. Reynolds. A plush Winston-Salem hotel that is the former home of R.J. Reynolds Tobacco is among those on the watch list of troubled assets because of commercial mortgage-backed securities. Triad Business Journal reports that PMC Property Group of Philadelphia, which owns the Kimpton Cardinal Building, was 60 days delinquent on the Kimpton loan as of June 15, having missed payments of $141,555 for April and May. Filings indicate the Cardinal owes $24.52 million on a $25 million loan originated in September 2018. New product developed at NC State will help train military dogs. Scientists at the Army Research Office and NC State University have collaborated on a way to train military working dogs, a realistic canine bite sleeve trainer. Trainers use bite training to teach military working dogs to assist in restraining a perpetrator, which could eliminate the need to use a weapon. But most bite sleeves are too bulky, researchers say. That's where their new invention comes in. The new bite sleeve provides military working dogs with what researchers describe as an authentic human skin texture, allowing for a full mouth bite and a more realistic training scenario. The bite sleeve is comprised of an outer silicone skin paired with an inner leather-based sleeve. The skin is a proprietary prosthetic-grade silicone product that looks and feels like human flesh and has an internal mesh support system for resilience. And it's already being used by the Army in training. And finally, Pinehurst, North Carolina courses rank high in new Golf Week ratings. A Golf Week ranking of the best courses you can play has Pinehurst number 2 well up the list, and lauded several of other courses in the Sand Hills as well. Our destination understands how important golf is not only to those who live here, but also to everyone around the world that chooses to visit this special place 365 days of the year, says Phil Wurz, president and CEO of the Pinehurst Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. The famed Donald Ross course is ranked number 3 in the annual Top 100 Best Courses You Can Play list. Also listed are Pinehurst number 4 at number 41, Mid Pines and Southern Pines number 42, Pine Needles and Southern Pines number 55, Linville Golf Course number 78, and Tobacco Road in Sanford number 99. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Banking, Tech, and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Wells Fargo to close some branches in North Carolina. Banking giant Wells Fargo just announced a trio of new branch closures in North Carolina. Disclosures to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency showed planned closures in Wendell, Wilmington, and Concord. 18 South Main Street, Wendell, 1701 Shipyard Boulevard, Wilmington, and 948 Concord Parkway, Concord. In 2020, the bank has notified the OCC of 11 branch closures in the state. In a recent interview, Mike Golden, who heads up the Raleigh market for the bank, says the COVID crisis has impacted the North Carolina operation, with a portion of its branches closed for months, primarily those without drive-thrus. "We have got a reopen plan for those branches that is tiered to when the need shifts," he says, pointing to the Crabtree Valley Mall location as an example. When the mall was closed, So was the branch. When the mall opened its doors, the branch returned to operation, Golden says. Social distancing is being followed, and customers are encouraged to bank digitally or via drive-thrus. The pandemic has driven a significant increase in the demand for digital options, Golden says, noting the bank saw a 23% surge in customers signing on to digital banking sites since the pandemic began, with the number of mobile check deposits increasing by 40%. He says the pandemic has accelerated the adoption of digital services across the industry. News of additional branch closures isn't entirely unexpected. Earlier this month, CEO Charlie Scharf said on an earnings call to expect cost cuts. PNC Bank trims branch count once again. Pittsburgh-based PNC has disclosed additional branch closures in North Carolina, including in the Triangle. The latest bulletin out of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency discloses a total of 52 PNC branch closures nationwide, the bank's biggest mass cut of the year, and it includes three in North Carolina: 2920 Jones Franklin Road in Raleigh, 101 East Rosemary Street in Chapel Hill, and 3333 Robin Hood Road, Winston-Salem. So far in 2020, PNC has filed notice with the OCC of 10 branch closures in North Carolina, including one in Raleigh's North Hills. In a statement, a PNC spokeswoman said, nearly three-quarters of the bank's customers don't use tellers for the majority of their transactions. As part of our ongoing commitment to provide the best possible service, we constantly evaluate our branches together with our other available channels of banking to ensure that they are most effectively meeting our customers' needs, she stated, adding that approximately 73% of consumer customers used non-teller channels for the majority of their transactions during the second quarter of 2020. Lipson's latest raise includes betting against PPP loan. A Raleigh startup's bet to reject a loan from the Paycheck Protection Program in favor of a capital raise has paid off. Real Magic, the brainchild of ShareFile founder Jesse Lipson, has closed on a $6 million raise, bringing its total funding haul to $12 million. We're lucky in this case. Our existing investors were still pretty excited about what we were doing, Lipson says. Real Magic's flagship product, Levitate, helps small and medium-sized businesses manage their professional relationships, something Lipson says has been vital since the pandemic began. With social distancing, it's that much more important to stay in touch by emailing or calling or reaching out electronically, Lipson says. I feel like we're well-positioned. When the pandemic struck, he says he wasn't sure how it would shake out for his headcount, currently around 80, so the firm applied for a Paycheck Protection Program loan, and it was accepted, he says. But we decided not to take it, Lipson says. Ultimately, we felt like other companies would benefit more from the funding than us because we were still doing well. It was a tough decision because it's hard to turn down money you can have, but I think it was the right one. Carriers at RDU Airport tanking traffic. Gary Kelly, CEO of Southwest Airlines, notes that his company is in intensive care as the pandemic continues to slash passenger numbers across the globe. In a July 24 letter to employees, he noted, "Year to date, we've lost almost $1.6 billion, with 95% of that occurring in the second quarter. That amount of losses for only one quarter almost wipes out our profits for an entire year." At Raleigh-Durham International Airport, all major airlines from Southwest to Delta Airlines to American Airlines to United Airlines report that corporate traffic has tanked. Typically, that's just more than half of RDU's passengers. Here's a look at how they are faring at RDU through June 30 in terms of enplaned passengers. Delta Airlines, 433,830 passengers, a 58% drop from 2019. American Airlines, 355,332 passengers, a 53.6% drop. Southwest Airlines, 263,427 passengers, a 57.8% drop from 2019. United Airlines, 154,359 passengers, a 61.6% drop. And Frontier Airlines, 70,447 passengers, a 69.3% drop from 2019. And finally on this page, in a section called He Said It, A quote from Jim Whitehurst, president of IBM, at a recent North Carolina Technology Association summit. Right now, I think we're seeing how important data and analytics is because data is going to guide us through this pandemic. It's going to inform decisions about when it's safe to return to work. And now we turn to Seth Thomas Gulledge's page on healthcare, higher ed. Colleges face drop-off in international students. The perfect storm battering the balance sheets of U.S. universities for 4 months is entering a new phase that threatens one of the sector's biggest cash cows, international students. Few regions are more threatened than the Triangle, which boasts a large concentration of foreign students bringing in millions in revenue. That gravy train is in jeopardy as the COVID-19 pandemic and the Trump administration's shifting immigration policies have siphoned travel from abroad, putting thousands of international students in limbo. A Business Journal's analysis of federal education data showed international student enrollment on U.S. campuses spiked 55% from the 2011 through 2019 academic years, enough to offset what otherwise would have been a 3% enrollment decline during the same span. As of last year, 8.3% of the 8.6 million full-time equivalent college students in the U.S. were classified as non-resident aliens by the U.S. Department of Education. The Triangle's largest universities have also seen a spike in reliance on international enrollment over the same period. According to Department of Education data, full-time enrollment of internationals has increased by 49% at NC State University, 48% at Duke University, and 28% at UNC Chapel Hill. Duke reports about 22% of its total enrollment as international students, with NC State at 12% and UNC at just 5%. Despite the difference, the three universities represent the highest revenue from international students in the state. When accounting for full tuition, room and board, plus fees and other costs for full-time students, the potential revenue at risk for Duke could reach $261 million if all of its international enrollment disappeared. At NC State, that figure is $147 million. For UNC, it's $67.5 million. Hatteras backs $3 million seed round for UNC spinout. A Triangle spinout company looking to develop its stem cell technology has wrapped up a $3.1 million seed investment led by a South Carolina venture capital firm and local investors. Chapel Hill-based Altis Biosystems recently announced the closing of an oversubscribed seed series investment round led by Greenville-based Venture South. According to Venture South, it invested over $1 million as the first and largest investor in the fundraising. Other investors in the round included RTP Capital and Durham's Hatteras Venture Partners, as well as other partners across the country, including members of the Atlanta Technology Angels and Central Texas Angel Network in Austin, Texas. Altis is one of many spin-out bioscience companies to emerge from local universities. It spun out of UNC Chapel Hill with the mission of making drug discovery faster and safer while reducing the need for animal testing. The company's technology is centered around a stem cell platform that was created as part of a National Institutes of Health Research Award to develop a microfluidic organ on a chip mimic of the human colon. Using that technology called ReplaGut, the company's platform produces a layer of human intestinal stem cells of either the small or large intestine. These cells can be used, according to the company, for screening, disease modeling, or microbiome research. Altis considers its intestinal platform to be the next generation for in vitro testing during drug development, the company says. The platform allows scientists to develop safe and more effective drugs using normal human intestinal tissue. According to documents filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the investment round included a total of 42 people with no minimum investment requirement. The first date of sale for the round was December 30 of last year. COVID-19 vaccine candidate shows promise in animal testing. Heat Biologics, which is pursuing a COVID-19 vaccine, is reporting that preclinical testing of its vaccine candidate is showing early success. The Morrisville firm announced July 29 that successful preclinical testing of the company's vaccine for COVID-19 demonstrated in vivo confirmations of vaccine immunogenicity in animal models, including the expansion of a T-cell response against the virus. The company said the testing demonstrated that the response killed virus cells in the lungs of animals. "We are pleased to report this significant milestone in the development of our COVID-19 vaccine," CEO Jeff Wolf said in a statement. "Specifically, our latest preclinical studies demonstrated immunogenicity, proof of concept, validating that the selected vaccine antigen may be appropriate for human testing." Former Duke doctor in the spotlight for disputed studies. A former Duke University doctor is in the spotlight over disputed studies related to COVID-19 treatments. The New York Times published a story on Dr. Sapan Desai, who provided data on a pair of published studies regarding COVID-19 treatments, including hydroxychloroquine, that have since been retracted by the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet. Both studies were penned by a lead author from Harvard University, and the data came from a company named Surgisphere, founded by Desai, who was also listed as an author on both studies. The studies were retracted in June after researchers from around the world raised doubts about the data. Desai, who completed his residency in general surgery at Duke before leaving, founded Surgisphere in 2008 during his time at Duke. The Times drew insight from his Duke colleagues. Dr. Vanessa Olsis, a former chief resident, told the paper, "You couldn't trust what he said. You would verify everything that he did." And finally, funding helps firm add gene therapy platform. An early-stage life science company backed by Hatteras Venture Partners has used its new funding to acquire the exclusive rights to a gene therapy platform targeting eye disease. Durham-based Altsina Therapeutics announced July 29 that it has acquired the exclusive rights to a gene therapy from French pharma giant Sanofi. The therapy targets GUCY2D-associated Leber congenital amaurosis, or LCA1, a genetic eye disease that affects the retina and is a leading cause of blindness in children. The acquisition follows an $8.1 million funding round at Cena closed earlier this year. The round was led by Durham-based Hatteras, and the company's investors also include the Foundation Fighting Blindness's RD Fund, Osage University Partners, PBM Capital, and the University of Florida. Sanofi originally licensed the technology from the University of Florida. It was first created in the laboratory of the Atsina's founders, Dr. Shannon Boy and Sanford Boy. And now we turn to the On Business page written by Matthias Miller. Congress looks for alternative to $600 weekly benefit. More than 25 million Americans received what could be their last $600 weekly payment in federal unemployment benefits July 25, unless Congress agrees to extend the program. In North Carolina, that means most people out of work due to the pandemic would see their weekly income slashed by about 70%. The maximum weekly pay from state unemployment insurance in North Carolina is $350 for up to 12 weeks. Senate Republicans in Washington, D.C. released their proposed aid package July 28, and it would cut the $600 weekly payments to $200. Some GOP lawmakers and White House officials say they are worried the current benefit discourages some from returning to work if they're making more to stay home and collect unemployment. Democrats, who've already passed a $3 trillion bill in the House, want to extend the $600 payments into 2021. Known as Federal Pandemic Unemployment Compensation, the program has already paid out more than $4.4 billion in North Carolina since March. Although preliminary data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics show unemployment fell to 7.6% in North Carolina in June. Unemployment rates for Black and Hispanic adults remain high. Nationally, white unemployment fell to 10.1% in June, compared to Black unemployment at 15.4%, and Hispanic unemployment at 14.5%. In North Carolina, women accounted for nearly 59% of new unemployment claims in April. During the Great Recession, men made up about 60% of claims filed in North Carolina. Lilia Peterson, a policy analyst at the North Carolina Center of Justice, said in a report, "This trend could be a result of the food service and hospitality industry being devastated. Manufacturing saw the greatest number of unemployment claims during the Great Recession." Politico recently reported state offices will need weeks to reprogram their systems to account for extensions or changes to the $600 weekly federal payments, which could create an inevitable gap in funding. Alexandra Sirota, director of the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, says a gap will be harmful for families dependent on unemployment insurance. Any gap is going to have harmful effects for families and the economy. People are very worried about whether they're going to be able to stay in their homes, put food on the table, and survive this crisis, Sirota says. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World. We start with the column this week written by Jennifer Toll Whiteside, who is the president and CEO of North Carolina Community Foundation, and Lori O'Keefe, who is the president and CEO of the Triangle Community Foundation. The headline, Donors Rally to Help Those in Need as Crisis from COVID-19 Continues. The pandemic and its economic ramifications created unprecedented challenges in an incredibly short time, challenges that continue to linger and grow. The nonprofit, business, and public sectors all face seismic shifts in how they work and what they do. We expect these challenges to last. Nonprofits are particularly vulnerable due to business models with revenue that is reliant on annual fundraising, combined with the growing need for services during and after the pandemic. These two combined could break the capacity and overwhelm the resources of our community organizations. Some estimate that 10 to 40% of nonprofits will close. These organizations are critical to our community's health and vibrancy. It is clear the effects of COVID-19 have disproportionately fallen on people of color. As we all know, inequities are exacerbated in times of crisis and disaster, and longstanding systemic health and social inequities have put communities of color at increased risk. As we mobilized rapid response funding into our communities, it was of vital importance to our organizations and to our donors to keep this top of mind. As community foundations, we are positioned to both determine and address the needs of the community. In response to the pandemic, we have worked to pivot direct funds where they are needed the most. Across the country, community foundations have raised more than $1 billion to help. In our region, through Triangle Community Foundation's Unrestricted Fund for the Triangle, a fund that allows for flexibility to respond quickly to pressing needs, the foundation has granted more than $450,000 since March to two United Way of the Greater Raleigh, of the Greater Triangle Rapid Response Funds, five local artist relief funds, the NC Funder Collaborative for Strong Latinx Communities Rapid Response Fund, five local relief funds focused on direct aid to local families who are not eligible for federal programs, and together with the Triangle Capacity Building Network, funding 29 organizations led by and serving people of color for general operating support during COVID-19. The increased need of the region's nonprofits and the necessary focus on inequities was not lost on TCF's donors. An additional $336,000 has been raised for the fund for the Triangle since the pandemic began. Donors rallied around the call for additional funding, particularly for undocumented residents, agricultural workers, and others disqualified from receiving this spring stimulus checks, continued unemployment benefits, and additional resources. TCF donors mobilized $109,000 through Fund for the Triangle for this cause alone. In addition, in response to a recent foundation podcast highlighting the funding of organizations led by and serving people of color during this time, donors have made an additional $41,000 in grants further funding this cause. On a statewide level, the North Carolina Community Foundation created the North Carolina Healing Communities Fund to respond to nonprofit needs stemming from the pandemic. The fund provides critical resources for nonprofits in North Carolina impacted severely through revenue loss and increased demand. The fund focuses on supporting nonprofits in marginalized communities that have been disproportionately affected by the virus and its economic impacts and have been underserved by other sources of financial assistance, specifically communities of lower wealth, communities of color, mostly rural communities, and where English may not be the primary language. This is a vital and challenging time for all of our communities. Now more than ever, we must come together to support and serve our neighbors, especially the most vulnerable. As community foundations, we're proud to play a role and are honored to steward these funds to serve the needs of our fellow North Carolinians. And in nonprofit news, Nonprofit highlights good works through photos. Activate Good, a Triangle nonprofit that mobilizes volunteers, has worked to create photos and stories highlighting local volunteers amidst the pandemic in partnership with photojournalist BC Cameron Yee. The collection includes photos of people serving the community in a variety of ways, from delivering groceries and helping animals up for adoption. These photos also show volunteers cleaning up downtown Raleigh after the May riots and working at the Interfaith Food Shuttle's Camden Street Garden, among others. As our community, the country, and the world continue to face enormous challenges as part of or resulting from the pandemic, we thought it was important to shine a light on some of the good being done too, said Activate Good Executive Director Amber Smith. We believe people have the capacity to rise above these times if we educate ourselves about the issues and commit to working together to address them. Walk to End Alzheimer's takes new approach. The 2020 Walk to End Alzheimer's in the Triangle, scheduled for October 10, is being transformed into a Walk is Everywhere model. The walk generally attracts thousands each year to raise awareness and funds to fight Alzheimer's disease. But this year, the Eastern North Carolina chapter of the Alzheimer's Association is encouraging participants to walk as individuals or in small groups on sidewalks, tracks, and trails across the Triangle. On October 10, an opening ceremony will feature local speakers and a presentation of promise flowers to honor the reasons participants decided to get involved. Next, everyone will walk on their own or in their own neighborhoods with their family and friends. Finally, the Alzheimer's Association will create the iconic Promise Garden in a view-only format that participants can drive by on a walk day to honor all those impacted by Alzheimer's. And finally, Wegmans donating $15,000 to Interfaith Food Shuttle. Wegmans is donating $15,000 to the Interfaith Food Shuttle to mark its new store opening in West Cary. The first of two checks for $7,500 was presented July 22, with the second coming in January. The funds will help at the Food Shuttle Farm, allowing the Interfaith Food Shuttle to produce higher quality food faster. We are grateful for Wegmans' generous support of our agricultural programs, specifically on our 14-acre farm, said Ron Pringle, Interfaith Food Shuttle's president and CEO. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. Time to forgive PPP loans and review next round of recipients. A $318,000 Lamborghini Huracan Evo, a $305,000 26-foot Pavati wake boat, a $13,000 trip to Saks Fifth Avenue and Graff Diamonds, and millions of saved jobs across the country, courtesy of the federal government. That's how some of the $530 billion of the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, money has been spent so far. There's still another $130 billion or so left for businesses interested in applying for it before August 8. But that deadline is expected to be extended as well. By most accounts, PPP was valuable for businesses. Hundreds of thousands of business owners acknowledged the money allowed them to keep operating during the first 3 months of the pandemic. While many saw a big drop in revenue because of reduced customer interaction, others got a gift from the government in the form of labor cost reimbursements, even though there was minimal impact on revenue. But the first act of PPP saga is about to end. Most businesses have spent the money and are now wondering whether the federal government will start sending them more money. Watching how Congress is eager to send and spend trillions of additional dollars, help is on the way for businesses in some form. But before any of those new actions get baked into the economy, Washington lawmakers must pass a law to automatically forgive all PPP loans under $150,000. That covers more than 80% of all businesses in the program. Since more money will soon be available, lawmakers should also attach a new rule. The second round of PPP for businesses who had the first round of PPP forgiven will be directly tied to the loss of business. I've heard too many stories of businesses getting PPP loans despite minimal impact on the revenue stream. It looks like so have the lawmakers, with some of them now adamant that the new round of stimulus should be directed to companies in specific industries hurt the most by the pandemic, hotels, restaurants, transportation companies, and municipalities. For businesses not seeking the forgiveness, the qualification should remain identical, as was with the original PPP loan rules. Everyone can use a low-interest loan these days. Then there are the lenders who act as the conduit to move the money to businesses. Most banks, credit unions, and private loan financiers are reluctant to embark on a new PPP journey without additional clarity from the SBA and the U.S. Treasury that the smaller loans would be forgiven from the first round. There's simply no way community banks, which played a major role in moving the money to businesses, would be able to handle the additional duty of processing new loans. They have to clear the books and register the interest fee windfall first before redeploying their staffers to do this all over again. What Washington is facing right now has turned from an economic problem to political insanity. Both parties are more than willing to throw trillions of dollars that they don't have at it, hoping it will resurrect the economy or buy votes in November. But what does not go away is the plight of businesses. This time around, let's hope Congress does the right thing for the right people and the right businesses. And now we turn to some general stories in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have a story written by Caleb Harshberger. Massive expansion unveiled at Durham's American Tobacco campus. One of the Triangle's most prominent downtown developments is about to get much bigger. Capital Broadcasting Company and its development partners, Hines and USAA Real Estate, unveiled plans July 28 for a massive new mixed-use destination and the latest expansion of CBC's American Tobacco campus in downtown Durham. Plans call for three new towers, plus structured parking at the site of the former University Ford property west of ATC, including a new multifamily high-rise up to 14 stories and a pair of state-of-the-art mixed-use office buildings showcasing Hines's newly developed all-timber construction concept. The expansion project will carefully and imaginatively fit with the historic look of the original American Tobacco campus, while embracing the amenities, efficiencies, and innovations of new builds, says Kurt Hartman, Hines Senior Managing Director. It's a natural fit with the numerous brick and beam buildings that already exist in Durham. Altogether, the project will feature 313,000 square feet of commercial space, 350 multifamily units, and 90,000 square feet of experiential retail, all situated on 11 acres at 601 Willard Street. Michael Goodman, CBC's Senior Vice President of Real Estate, says the plans have been in the works since the company bought the University Ford site in 2016 for $23.8 million. The plan was always to continue American Tobacco and continue that momentum, he says, and for that we directly sought out Hines. Hines director Paul Zarian says that even back then, Durham was among the top cities on the company's list for potential future development. And in the years since, more and more urban development has cropped up around the site. Over the last 3 years, it's really become the hole in the donut, Zarian says. You're really adding a special place to one of the last infill large-scale development sites in one of the most dynamic submarkets in the country. Together with the existing campus, the expansion will bring the development to just under 2 million square feet. The site is already entitled for the project, though site plans still have to go through the approval process with the city. The companies expect construction to begin in late 2021 or early 2022 in the hopes of delivering the project in 2023. Our next year will be an intensive design process, Zarian says. No tenants have yet been finalized, though Goodman says the company is in extensive talks with several potential tenants. Hines and CBC will lead the leasing efforts. In addition to the office space, he says the companies are looking to create a destination with offerings for residents and families. From a family standpoint, downtown Durham hasn't had a lot to consider. I think this project has an opportunity to be just that, Goodman says. We're working hard on a theater, working hard on grocery, we're working hard on a retail destination. The project is still in the design phase, and the names and height for the two office buildings have yet to be finalized. These two will feature Hines's new T3 all-timber construction concept. T3 stands for Timber, Transit, and Technology, which seeks to bring a vintage aesthetic to a contemporary structure. Boston firm lands upscale apartment project in Cary. This article also written by Caleb Harshberger. A high-end apartment complex in the Triangle has changed hands in a nearly $70 million sale. Boston-based Eaton Vance's Real Estate Investment Group closed on the Mark at Weston for $69.3 million July 24. The 302-unit sold for $229,470 per unit. The property is situated on 8.5 acres at 3101 Rise Drive in Cary, near a collection of retailers and down the road from the Park West Village Retail Center. Altogether, the property features 302 apartments across four stories. Rental rates at the Market Weston range from as low as $1,032 for a single-bedroom unit to as high as $2,121 for a three-bedroom unit, according to Apartments.com. Amenities include a pool, fitness center, coffee and hot tea bar, game room, and more. The seller is an affiliate of CWS Capital of Austin, Texas. CWS paid $60.4 million for the property 4 months after it opened in 2016, after pooling the money from a collection of investment sources. Brokerage firm Newmark Knight Frank Vice Chairman Sean Wood, John Heimberger, and Dean Smith, Senior Managing Director Alex Okulski, and Managing Directors Jason Kahn and John Monroe represented the seller. DHIC plans affordable senior living complex. Raleigh-based DHIC has filed plans for a new affordable senior living community in Northeast Raleigh. DHIC, which traditionally builds affordable housing rental projects in the region, filed site plans earlier this month for a project called Primavera, featuring 164 apartments available to seniors 55 years and older, making less than average median income in the Triangle. The project is situated on 11.2 acres at 5001 Spring Forest Road, inside Interstate 540 and near a collection of retailers, apartments, and neighborhoods off Lewisburg Road. Filings with the city call for 164 units across two buildings, including 130 one-bedroom units and 34 two-bedroom units. Units will be available to seniors with incomes from 70, 60, 50, and 40% of the area median income. DHIC Vice President of Real Estate Development Natalie Britt says this will be the group's first project with 70% AMI units, which help finance more units reserved for lower income levels. Altogether, the property will average 60% AMI, she says. DHIC has currently budgeted $29.6 million for the project, and Britt hopes to close on the property by the end of the year and begin construction by next spring. Elsewhere in Raleigh, DHIC, the Presbytery of New Hope, and the Presbyterian Homes Incorporated are moving ahead with plans to bring a new affordable housing complex to the site of the now-closed Milner Memorial Presbyterian Church. And we have one more article by Caleb Harshberger. Work progresses on new Clayton development. A large residential development is taking shape in Clayton, with plans calling for more than 200 new homes and apartments just minutes from downtown. Clayton home builder 127 Homes has begun work on Academy Point, which is set to include 133 single-family homes, 110 apartments, and 12 townhomes. The project is situated at 235 East Wilson Street by Cooper Academy and within walking distance of downtown Clayton. Construction is underway on the single-family portion of the site and is yet to begin on the apartments. Work is complete on the townhomes and residents have begun moving in. Single-family homes will come in a variety of layouts, including alley load house plans and street loading house plans with a single-car garage. Alley load homes will not have a garage and will range in size from 1,100 to just under 1,600 square feet, with prices starting at around $194,900. Single-car garage homes will be a bit bigger at around 1,400 to just under 1,600 square feet, and pricing starting at around $215,000. Clayton-based Jacqueline Smith Properties is the realtor on the project, and sales have already begun. The townhomes feature four triplex-style buildings. Six of these units are currently occupied, and the developer expects the remaining six to fill by this fall. Rental rates at the townhomes are around $1,400 per month. Work has yet to begin on the apartments, and rental rates have yet to be finalized. Amenities at Academy Point include extensive walking trails in and around the development. And in news from around the state, we have a story from Jennifer Thomas of the Charlotte Business Journal. Owner, I cannot go bankrupt trying to survive. Cara Taddeo feels like she's playing roulette with her businesses every day. She and her husband, Tom, have spent the last decade invested financially, personally, and professionally in VBGB Beer Hall and Garden and a sister concept, 8.2.0, at the Avid Exchange Music Factory in Charlotte. Now, their fate is wrapped up in the COVID-19 pandemic. Every week is a gamble. Our goal is clearly to keep alive, but we'll see, Cara Taddeo says. You can't risk it all on something other than yourself. This year marks the 10th anniversary for the VBGB. That German-style beer hall and garden encompasses 10,000 square feet, including a 6,500 square foot patio. The couple added 8.2.0 in 2016. Their entire business model is at odds with the pandemic. They found success hosting gatherings, sometimes as many as 50 a week for groups of 50 to 400. Current limitations cap gatherings at 10 people indoors and 25 outdoors. Restaurant capacity is limited to 50%. Business is down 70% at VBGB, and 8.2.0 has yet to reopen. It's terrifying. My husband and I have put our entire life into these two places. This is truly a mom-and-pop business, she says. Cara Taddeo estimates lost sales of about $2 million across both businesses because of the shutdown and lingering limitations. The goal is to break even and make it to 2021, she says. PPP funding of $350,000 has helped. Just 15 employees are on payroll, down from 65 pre-COVID. Their landlord has been flexible about rent. I cannot go bankrupt trying to survive, she says. And we'll wrap up with the Business Survey Pulse. The question, will college football have a season? There were 212 responses. 41% say no, too much risk. 26% say yes, but only conference games. 17% say yes, but in the spring. And 16% say yes, too much money is at stake. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.